This episode of Food for Thought is brought to you by the listeners of this podcast. That means you listening right now. You can show your support for this podcast by becoming a patron. You can go to joyfulvegan.com or you can go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau. You can also just click on the links in the show notes here and you can choose the level that's right for you. Thank you so much in advance. Today's episode is Black Cats and Halloween, the history behind the superstition. Welcome, everyone, to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I am your host. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Welcome to the 17th year of the Food for Thought podcast. I hope you're enjoying it. If you have been listening that long, well done you. The hardest part about recording this episode today was having to come inside because it is an incredibly gorgeous day. This is my favorite time of year. You may have heard me say that about every other season because I do love the change of seasons, and I defy anyone who says there is not a change of seasons in California. That is not true. There are. And this time of year, autumn, is a really magical time of year. It's actually the warmest time of year here in Northern California. Summer is actually quite cloudy and foggy and cold and unpleasant, in my opinion. But autumn is just sunny and beautiful. And of course, there's this gorgeous low light and there's just a beautiful smell in the air. It's fall. I also love this time of year because I love Halloween. I love the harvest season, especially when it comes to cooking and baking. I love this time of year. It's my husband's birthday on October 27th, and we usually have a party and a costume party for Halloween and to celebrate David's birthday. And I like doing topical, thematic, seasonal episodes, of course, as they relate to the theme of this podcast, animals and food, etc. And so I've done other episodes around Halloween and animals, and I invite you to listen to one called Animal Themed Halloween Films. And I promise you, these are not films where the animals are victims. These are not gory films. I am not a fan of horror films, not the horrible, scary, have nightmares kind of films, but there are some good animal themed Halloween films that I invite you to check out. And then I also have an episode called Eco-Friendly Zero Waste Halloween Treats. So if you're looking for trick-or-treat treats and you want to reduce packaging and waste as much as possible, go listen to that episode. And pardon me, but a black cat has just walked into my office. I'm not kidding. This black cat who will not let me record unless he's sitting on my lap. He may vocalize, he may not, but that's exactly what we're going to talk about today. Maybe he knew that, or he's just a mama's boy and doesn't like to leave my side. This is Charlie. So I am a huge proponent of black cats. I do have black cats. I've only ever had black cats. My cats are tuxedo cats, so they're black with white markings, but they are black cats for all intents and purposes, and black cats still get a bad rap, and I want to talk today about why. And I want to talk about why certain animals are synonymous with Halloween. We're going to mostly talk about black cats, but of course we also have bats and rats and owls and spiders and ravens and crows and wolves and toads, but we're going to focus mostly on black cats. What's the history behind this? Why are these animals associated with this holiday? Why are black cats in particular associated with this holiday? And why are black cats associated with witches? Did Pope Gregory IX issue a papal bull during the 13th century that called for the mass extermination of black cats? So what's the history behind all of this, and what does it mean for us and mostly the animals today? So that's what we're going to explore in today's episode. First and foremost, let's just take a quick look at Halloween and what it's all about. It will just ground us and give us a context because that's what we're talking about today. So Halloween's roots can be traced back over 2,000 years to the Celtic festival of Samhain. Samhain was celebrated in what is now Ireland, the United Kingdom also, and parts of northern France. And it marked the end of the harvest season and the beginning of winter, or the darker half of the year. It's one of the reasons this time of year is so mysterious and so, I think, romantic and lovely. But this time of year has often, both in secular and religious contexts seen as a liminal time when the boundary between the living and the dead was blurred, when the spirits could more easily come into this world and were particularly active. The souls of the dead were also said to revisit their homes seeking hospitality, and places were set at the dinner table and by the fire to welcome them. There was a belief that the souls of the dead return home on one night of the year and must be appeased. This goes back to ancient times, and it's found in many cultures. In Christianity, from the 4th century, feasts commemorating Christian saints and martyrs were held in various places by various churches on various dates, mostly in springtime. So there's an association with kind of saints and a feast day for saints, mostly around Easter time, to be honest. So that was back in the 4th century. And it changed over the centuries, but in 837, Pope Gregory the 4th, this is a different pope than the one we're going to talk about a little later on, but Pope Gregory the 4th in 837 ordered the official observance of All Saints' Day every November 1st, and he extended its celebration to the entire church. So no longer do you have just kind of, you know, local churches, local groups, local cults just kind of celebrating and commemorating saints and martyrs. You now have it declared by the Pope, by the church. There's an official observance, All Saints' Day, every November 1st. And there are different theories as to why this date was chosen, why it was chosen from moving from the springtime to this time. That's not the topic for today's episode, but it certainly makes sense that honoring the dead at this time of year in the winter, when it's the time when things die, when nature goes to sleep, it's something that resonated with Christians, just as it had resonated with the Celtic-speaking peoples who commemorated the dead at the beginning of winter. So for this observance, it was a common custom for Christians to begin their liturgical celebrations the night before All Saints' Day, the night before or the evening. So the evening before All Saints' Day became known as All Hallows' Eve, hallow meaning holy, and een being an abbreviation of evening. So obviously later this became the word Halloween, Halloween, which is All Hallows' Eve. So it was the beginning of All Saints' Day, starting the evening before. Later on, Christian missionaries introduced All Souls' Day on November 2nd, which perpetuated the idea of the living coming into contact with the dead around the same time of year, conveniently. So All Souls' Day is a day to pray for all souls among Catholics. Prayers are offered for those who are in purgatory. I grew up Catholic, so this is a thing where you're kind of waiting to get into heaven, and you're just hanging out in this middle place called purgatory. And so All Souls' Day is a time for the living to pray for those souls in purgatory so that they will get to heaven. And All Souls' Day is when Catholic churches would have a Book of the Dead, in which parishioners would have an opportunity to write the names of relatives to be remembered. Quite lovely. Now you're probably making the connections between the Day of the Dead, a holiday traditionally celebrated on November 1st and 2nd. So you can see the connection here in Mexico in particular. And so that was All Souls' Day, November 2nd. All Saints' Day was November 1st. All Hallows' Eve was the evening before All Saints' Day. And so these 3 days together are collectively called All Hallowtide. All Hallowtide. And this was a time when Western Christians would honor saints and pray for the recently departed who have yet to reach heaven or who have maybe reached heaven. And so during this time, Christians would come together to ask for God's blessing and protection from evil in the world. By the late 12th century, so now we're moving on, traditions included ringing bells, ringing church bells to commemorate the souls in purgatory. Additionally, there was the practice of criers who were dressed in black, parading the streets, tolling a mournful bell and urging all good Christians to remember people who died, the souls especially in purgatory. And then Halloween was eventually brought to North America by European immigrants, particularly the Irish, the Scottish, and the Welsh. And during the 20th century, the observance largely became a secular one, which has continued to evolve. And the modern imagery of Halloween comes from many sources, and has developed over the centuries, including such Halloween symbols related to the themes of death, of evil, of witches, of their common cohorts, black cats, and all of these animals who are associated with darkness in terms of their behavior, in terms of their appearance, in terms of their habits, and in terms of our perception of them and superstitions that surround them. So that's all related to this time of year when there is a real awareness of the living and the dead, the darkness and the light, especially going into the darkness. There's a lot to be said there. And I didn't want to spend too much time talking about how each, you know, kind of ancient tradition in both, again, kind of secular, pagan, Christian, religious, Catholic context developed into where we are today. But there's a lot to say about the food and why we do associate certain foods with this holiday. Please let me know if this is an episode you're interested in, because I'm thinking of doing one on the food around Halloween. And I'm not talking about like candy corn. I'm talking about, you know, like plant-based food. And a lot of it goes back again to Christians who observed this time of year because it was a holy time of year and who abstained from meat. And if you listen to the episode on Advent that I did, it's called something like Fasting and Abstinence During Advent. And I do talk also about Lent related to Easter. These were these times leading up to these high holy days, especially in terms of Easter, Lent leading up to Easter, and Advent leading up to Christmas. And one of my arguments is, you know, for most of the year, Christians especially were asked to abstain from meat as a way to honor their faith. So here we are again at another tradition, another observance, another festival, feast days, specifically related to the saints and martyrs and the dead. And once again, you have the parishioners being asked to abstain from meat. And so there are certain foods that are associated with that because people were not eating meat. And of course, some of it has to do with the fact that we're in the harvest season, so people would associate apples, obviously, with this time of year, for instance, or persimmons or pomegranates, because that's what was being harvested this time of year. But there's also more to be said. And if you're interested in that, let me know. I'm kind of leaning towards it, but I'd like to hear your feedback. By the way, I'll take this moment to say that there are a couple online classes you can join me for. I'm testing them out again. We were doing cooking classes online pretty frequently, especially during lockdown, and I've carried over a couple, so I have, not surprisingly. One is on autumn foods and abundance and fall abundance and fall feasting foods and soups, and it's a really wonderful menu if you're interested. And the other one is on constructing and making and baking and decorating gingerbread house. So if you are interested in that, go to joyfulvegan.com and you can sign up for those classes. If it doesn't reach the minimum, the classes don't reach the minimum, then they're not going to happen. So if you're interested, just hop over to joyfulvegan.com and register today. Okay, so let's talk about these animals, taking them as a whole, the bats, the owls, the spiders, the rats, the ravens, the crows, the black cats. There are some commonalities, right? I mean, if you stopped and thought about it, it's not a huge leap to understand why some of these or all of these animals are associated with Halloween and this time of year. First of all, one of the commonalities is that many of these animals are nocturnal, right? So you've got bats, you've got owls, you've got wolves, you've even got cats. They're all nocturnal animals, meaning they're active during the night. And so they engage in these mysterious activities that no one can see, right? So for that reason alone, they've been cloaked in superstition since ancient times. And Halloween being a holiday that traditionally celebrates the supernatural and creatures who come to life at night, it aligns with this theme of darkness and mystery. Relatedly, a lot of these animals are also predators, and as such, they're feared or disdained for that very reason. They're depicted as dangerous, as menacing, as bloodthirsty, and of course, you can't get more bloodthirsty than vampire bats, who literally live off of blood, especially of large animals. But even non-vampire bats have been associated with spirits and darkness and evil, and thus Halloween, right? So ancient Celtic-speaking people would light large bonfires as darkness approached, to ward off the darkness, but also to ward off the evil spirits of the night. And the glow and the warmth of the fires attracted mosquitoes and other flying insects, which attracted hungry bats, who would swoop and dart in and out of the bonfire's light in search of their prey. So they've been associated with, again, kind of the night and the darkness and Halloween. By virtue of their appearance, of course, many of these animals are black, and that color has long been associated with mystery, with the unknown, with fear, with evil, with death, with mourning. I mean, mourning, not mourning, but mourning, right? And so we have crows and ravens and bats and wolves and cats, all of whom are black. Well, black cats are black and black wolves are black, but bats and rats and ravens and crows, all black. Related to that, you've got these animals who are associated with dark, hidden places, such as caves and caverns and dens, bats in caves and caverns, wolves in dens, owls in trees. They're heard, but you can't see them, right? Bats and crows and ravens, too dark at night to see. So you only see their shadowy silhouettes, or you just hear them, or spiders who usually hide, or they spin webs in dark corners and abandoned places. So the idea of being hidden, that adds to the mystery of these animals. And then we have the stories going back hundreds of years, both in the oral tradition as well as in the written tradition of literature and folklore. We have movies that depict these animals in ways that have captured our imagination. So a few examples are Bram Stoker's Dracula and countless other vampire-themed movies who portray bats as supernatural and eerie, sometimes evil, right? You have Shakespeare, who characterized crows and ravens as harbingers of evil and doom in Macbeth and Othello. Same with Edgar Allan Poe's poem, The Raven, portrays the bird as a harbinger of doom. You have Hitchcock's The Birds, right, which features menacing flocks, mostly of crows and ravens. They still have that reputation today because of that film. I mean, we could go back to like Little Red Riding Hood and the big bad wolf, who's a symbol of danger and deception. And of course, you have werewolves. So wolves are ever changing. They're unpredictable. They're untrustworthy. They're dangerous, right? Even a collection of crows is called a murder. And just in general, we have horror stories and horror films that have featured these animals in ominous and supernatural context. So in all these ways, we have popular culture perpetuating the idea that these animals are, again, kind of aligned with darkness, evil, mystery, etc. Superstition, I mean, just historical superstitions or superstitions that are rooted in history that have played a role in the association of these animals with darkness and Halloween. Black cats in particular, who were believed to be connected to witches, and their presence on Halloween was thought to bring bad luck. So let's talk about witches and the occult and black cats, because black cats have been associated with witches and Satan and Halloween for a very long time. When did this start? How far back can we trace this association? What are the social and cultural implications and consequences of such an association? Now, for the record, black cats do have some positive associations in some cultures, in some Celtic-speaking nations, in Japanese folklore, but in most Western cultures, black cats have typically been looked upon as a symbol of evil omens, specifically being suspected of being the familiars of witches, or actually shape-shifting witches themselves, so witches who turned into cats. And so you can't trust a cat, because if there's a cat who crosses your path, it might be a witch who is just in the form of a cat. And so, of course, that would be an evil omen. And so this goes back hundreds of years to the Middle Ages, when these dark cats, these dark felines, were considered a symbol of the devil, because the devil could also change and shapeshift, and they could change into cats. That's one of the forms they would change into. So if you saw a black cat, could be the devil, could be a witch, could be just some dark magic happening. And so black hats have been associated with that for hundreds of years. And so we talked a little bit about the color of cats and black animals being associated with darkness and mystery and evil. But really, it's not just black cats. Cats in general were seen as the devil's minions. It wasn't just a black cat. It was all cats. But black cats did kind of get landed on as the ultimate kind of minions of the devil, right? It wasn't like just tabby cats, but black cats in particular. And so it goes back to cats just in general, who have long been misunderstood and maligned, yes, revered in some cases, but it really depends on when we're talking about, what culture we're talking about, how long ago we're talking about. And this is not a history on cats, this episode, but we have to go back a little bit to understand again how cats' reputation changed over the years. So the bonds between humans and cats can be traced to some of the world's earliest civilizations. I don't even have to say it because you know for sure, ancient Egypt stands out as the most obvious. Even those of us who are not versed in ancient history or ancient Egyptian history know the association between cats and Egyptians. And it's true. In ancient Egypt, cats held a sacred status, with the goddess Bastet frequently portrayed in feline form, occasionally embodying the qualities of a powerful lioness. So the act of harming a cat was strictly prohibited. And according to Herodotus, the Greek historian Herodotus, when a domestic cat passed away, it would lead to a household-wide period of mourning, including the shaving of eyebrows. And when a cat died, families would bring the cat to the revered city of Bubastis for mummification and burial in consecrated repositories. So by virtue of that alone, it's evidence of how revered cats were in this culture. Now, when it came to the ancient Romans' opinion of the cat, on one hand, the domestic cat lacked the qualities of duty and obedience and loyalty that the Romans highly valued. On the other hand, the cat inherently embodied traits of freedom and independence and autonomy, which were qualities that the Romans unmistakably admired. So in that vein, the Romans regarded the cat as a symbol of freedom, representing the goddess Liberta, Latin for liberty or freedom. And Liberta was a minor but widely worshipped Roman deity. And she's often depicted with a cat. If you want to see what Liberta looks like, just think about the Statue of Liberty. That's basically based on this Roman deity. And also in Roman mythology, there are several tales of the goddess Diana transforming herself into a cat, you know, being a huntress and all of that. Now, that may have come from Greek mythology. The Romans obviously took Greek gods and goddesses and made them part of their own family of gods and goddesses. In this case, they took Artemis, who was the Greek goddess of war and hunting, and they made her Diana in the Roman pantheon. But the point is, that was a positive depiction of her. Now, when we move to ancient Greece, cats are not mentioned very often in Greek literature, although Aristotle observed in his History of Animals that female cats were naturally lecherous. Aristotle didn't have a lot of good things to say about animals, to be honest. You had Plutarch, who associated cats with cleanliness. Pliny connected them with lust. So this, still today, we associate cats with lust and lechery. Aesop linked them with cunning and deviousness. So again, this is often how cats are still depicted. Like, it's like thousands of years later, we're still talking about them like that. And subsequently, the Greeks blended their own goddess Artemis with the Egyptian goddess Bastet and eventually transferred Bastet's cat-related attributes to Artemis. So you had some positive depictions of cats in ancient Greece. In Ovid's Metamorphoses, during the gods' flight to Egypt and their transformation into animal forms, the goddess Diana, or Artemis, takes on the form of a cat. However, it's a mixed bag. In Greek mythology, you also have the cat's connection with Galinthius, who was transformed into a cat by the goddess Hera as a punishment. And so, because the cat was linked to the Greek goddess of the underworld. So you've got a bit of a mixed bag in the ancient world, but it turns pretty dark for cats when we get to the Middle Ages. During the Middle Ages, cats were generally disapproved of. At best, they were tolerated because they could control vermin, quote unquote, right? Rats, especially in mice. And at worst, they were perceived as agents of darkness, and they were associated with Satan. So, you know, not great. The association between black cats and Halloween can be traced back to various historical beliefs and superstitions. One of the most enduring is the medieval European belief that black cats in particular were witches' familiars, that they aided them in the dark arts. But what I think is really important is that in unpacking this, it's not simply that cats had a poor reputation because they were associated with witches. It's that they were associated with women and the feminine. For thousands of years, cats have been seen, and still are, as feminine creatures. Carried over from Egypt, no doubt, where the goddess Bastet was associated, not only with warfare, but also with motherhood and fertility and the cat. Right? And so the cat has long been seen as a feminine creature. The Norse goddess Freya is also associated with the feline. It was believed that she had a chariot pulled by large cats. You have another very powerful female figure associated with cats. And in general, they've been considered protectors. So for all of their bad reputation, they are seen as being protectors and nurturers, just as human women are. What's more, being nocturnal, cats are associated with the moon, with the night, both of which are considered feminine. The moon is considered feminine, right? The night is considered feminine. And cats are often perceived as independent and mysterious creatures endowed with feminine characteristics of intuition, of having this enigmatic allure, and having a connection to the unknown. These are all traits that are traditionally attributed to the feminine. Even their bodies are seen as feminine. They're sleek, they're clean, they're agile. And you're probably thinking, all that sounds pretty good. Like, there's nothing about that that's negative, but it's all negative if you consider the poor light in which women and the feminine were perceived in the Middle Ages, right? So you have the cult of the Virgin Mary in the High Middle Ages. You have the French Romantic tradition of courtly love, which elevated women's status. But women were also closely associated with Eve and the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. Women were considered innately sinful, lusty, and responsible for man's first fall. I'm using the language of what it would have been considered man's first fall, as well as whatever struggles each individual man after Adam had to endure. It's all because of women. So couple that with the negative associations of the sexuality of cats. They're nocturnal, they play with their prey, they scream during copulation. Equate that to women and to the patriarchal culture of the Middle Ages, and the cat and women are not to be trusted. And so it follows that you have this association of cats with suspicious women, with solitary women, with witchcraft, with the dark arts, with just darkness, with the night. And it's not a huge leap to cats and women witches, because witches were mostly considered women, being in cahoots with the devil. Obviously, that's a leap, but it's not a huge leap for people at this time. The devil that the early Christians genuinely feared. And so as a result, cats and women were seen as threats. Cats, like the women accused of witchcraft, tended to exhibit a healthy disrespect of authority. You can't tell cats what to do. They don't fawn like dogs, right? They might be helpful when it comes to vermin, but in the church and in this time, everybody was part of the church. Everyone was part of the church. Neither independent women nor independent animals were to be tolerated. And so, as I said, at some point, we don't have the exact moment, but at some point, the pairing of witches with cats narrowed to black cats, those cats, black as night. And they were believed to be the companions of witches in medieval Europe. And some people even thought witches were reborn as black cats, right? And so given the belief in medieval Europe that the devil and witches were capable of taking the form of black cats, it makes sense that the superstitions surrounding crossing their paths developed. As I said earlier, it was a prevalent myth where many people believe that Satan could turn himself into a cat when socializing with witches. And so a black cat crossing your path could be on a mission from a witch, could be the devil in disguise. And so this superstition has persisted, and it persists today. People are still, you know, they still have a superstition. If a black cat crosses your path, it's still considered a bad omen. And so it was believed that witches made pacts with the devil and used black cats as their familiars. These familiars were thought to assist witches in performing malevolent magic and carrying out evil deeds. And black cats were thought to be involved in satanic rituals, which added to their reputation of being sinister. And in both Celtic and later Christian traditions, black cats were also linked to notions of bad luck and evil. They were seen as omens of impending doom, reinforcing the association with Halloween. Now, this is when we get to this legend, this myth, this story that Pope Gregory IX issued a papal bull in the 1230s in which he declared that all cats were the instruments of Satan and that all cats should be killed. Especially black cats, who were particularly Luciferian. So that is this persistent myth, story, legend, and it's popular and it's persistent. And it's one that emerges from the church's theological thinking around cats, all the things I've just described about Satan and demons and such, right? Because cats fly in the face of the Christian idea of God putting the natural world and its creatures here for humanity's benefit. People can make all manner of animals do what you like, but you can't really make a cat do anything. I can lure my cats with my affection and love. But it's true, right? I mean, that's one of the things that's so wonderful about cats is that they are incredibly autonomous, and that's one of the things that makes them problematic for a lot of people. And so that, according to the medieval church, is because, not because they're just different and interesting beings, but it's because they are invested with the spirit of the devil. And so that's how cats were viewed. And so is it true? Did the Pope call for the culling of all cats in Europe? So let's take a look at what's going on at this time that inspired this papal bull, because there is a papal bull written in 1233. Now I'm going to jump ahead and just say, if you're thinking if the word bull, because it is spelled B-U-L-L, is an animalogy, and if you don't know what an animalogy is, I'll tell you, it is a animal-related word or expression. I coined that term to talk about all of the words and expressions we have that come from animals, and you can go check out my spinoff short running podcast called Animology. And bull is a great example of one that you might think, oh, is that an animology? The answer is no, it's not, because the word bull in this case comes from Latin bulla, B-U-L-L-A, which meant seal, S-E-A-L. It actually comes from classical Latin meaning a blob or a bubble, because the you'd have a ball of wax and then you'd press the impression on it to get your seal. And so bulla in this case just meant seal. And so a papal bull is a type of official document or decree issued by the Pope. And so you do have this papal bull in 1233. It's called Vox Rama. And you do have cats mentioned in this particular papal bull. So let's talk about what this bull was all about and why people think that he was calling for the basically genocide on all cats. And so the 13th century was marked by profound superstition and witnessed the beginning of the demonization of heretics by the church. So if you don't know what heresy is in religious terms, heresy refers to any belief that significantly deviates from established beliefs or customs, especially those acknowledged as the standard beliefs or customs or doctrines of a religious institution. Heretics and heresy, they're in Judaism, they're in Islam, they're in Christianity. But in this case, as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, any heresy was considered something that had to be just kind of completely blotted out. It had to be completely removed. So heretics at this time, and you're getting a sense of what the superstition was at this time, you know, especially when it came to Satan, and people really believed that this was an evil incarnate and would walk upon the earth, and you could see the devil, but you couldn't necessarily identify him because he was hiding in all of these forms. Forms like black cats, forms like bats, forms like witches. And so there was the devil incarnate in these beings. And so this was a very real belief, concern, perspective, worldview. I mean, it just was. This is at a time before people used science to confirm the natural occurrences. I mean, this is what people believed. I know it's really hard for us modern folk to kind of wrap our brains around that, but this is what people believed. And so in the 13th century, there was so much superstition around heretics who were accused of lacking belief in the Catholic faith, and the blame was put on the influence of the devil. So if people were lacking belief in the Catholic faith, it was because of the devil. And so during this period, there was a push to dispatch inquisitors sanctioned by the Pope and local bishops to identify potential heretics. And so in the early 1230s, Pope Gregory IX designated several papal inquisitors to oversee different regions. There was France, there was Italy, there were portions of Germany. And one of these inquisitors was named Conrad von Marburg, who initiated an inquisition in Mainz, Germany, who got a little too much pleasure from his job. He liked his job a little too much. And so reportedly, allegedly, through the use of torture and terror and intimidation, Conrad claimed to have exposed a satanic cult that venerated devils in the guise of a demonic man and a sinister black cat. So the issue of the Vox in Rama is what this bull was called, this Vox in Rama bull in 1233, was a response to Conrad's allegations. And in this bull, Gregory denounces this demonic worship, right? He urges both the religious and secular authorities within the diocese to respond to this cult and to root out these witches. And the bull provides a really full account of their satanic rite. This is all described by Conrad. And Gregory is kind of reiterating it in this bull that he is sending to the authorities in Germany, for instance, to say, we got to get rid of these cults. We got to get rid of these people. So he is recounting what has been described by Conrad. And this description and created an image that was to be used for all future depictions of witches' festivals, and one that established the cat as the creature of the devil. Like, it was already believed, but now it's like establishing the cat as the creature of the devil. And the account begins by describing the initiation of novices to the coven. And so firstly, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but firstly, they're greeted by an abnormally large frog or toad who's behind they must kiss, and then they come across this man that has a fearful pallor and thinness, whose task was to suck out every last remnant of faith in the Catholic Church from their soul, right? It's basically the devil. And the novice then feasted with the rest of the congregation, after which they assembled to pay homage to a black cat, which emerged from a kind of statue, which normally stands in place where these meetings are held, but started moving and walking. And then each person returns back to his place, and they speak in this incantation, and they incline their heads toward the cat, and they say, "Forgive us, Master, and we must obey," right? And after that, the whole coven was required to kiss the cat's behind. And once they had done this, there was a wild sexual orgy, right? That's basically what Conrad comes back to the Pope and says, this is what I found. And so the Pope's like, okay, we got to get rid of this. And so this is the document that he writes. And it has been cited over the centuries, even by people who know nothing about Pope Gregory or Christian history or heresies, as evidence that the Pope said, yeah, all cats are evil. Let's just kill all cats. He doesn't say any of that in the bull at all. What's really happening is that Gregory's talking about this ritual carried out by a satanic sect, as reported by this overzealous inquisitor named Conrad von Marburg, whose job it was to rid Germany of heretics. So, you know, he had plenty of reason to stoke the Pope's fears of heretical activity. You know, he wanted to keep his job. You want to find heretics? I'm going to go find them, you know, by whatever means necessary. And he does, right? So, you know, the account's ridiculous, most likely untrue, right? Mostly we know that because no cat would ever let you kiss him on the behind. Or walk backwards. I think he walked backwards to the statue or something like that. Like something ridiculous. Like that's how we know that it's not true, because cats are not going to walk backwards if you tell them to. That's the only reason we know this is untrue. I mean, of course it's untrue, right? And so the point is, the most you could say about cats from this papal bull is that they're perhaps among the icons worshipped by a satanic cult. Like, sure, that's possibly true, but the bull is not a clarion call to kill all cats in Europe. Rather, it was a letter sent to authorities warning them about a satanic cult. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that even though there was no evidence that Pope Gregory IX called for a cat cull in Europe, that cats were cuddled and loved. I'm not saying that at all. During the Middle Ages, it was not uncommon for cats to be tortured and rounded up and killed, given their association with evil. For instance, in medieval Ypres in Belgium, there was a festival called Kattenstedt, meaning Festival of the Cats. And the tradition was to throw cats from the belfry tower, the bell tower, to expel evil spirits. There is a happy ending, I promise. Another story goes that this festival was started because it was a way to control the cat population after they were used to hunt rats and vermin to protect the wool in this town. So apparently cats were introduced into the cloth hall to combat vermin. And after the wool was sold in the springtime and there was no more wool that needed to be protected, the cats were thrown from the bell tower. This is the story. The last recorded event of this kind was in 1817. So there is evidence that this actually occurred. But since the 1930s, there has been an alternative version of Kattenstedt that you can see for yourself. You can experience yourself if you go to Ypres today, because every 3 years, on the second Sunday of May, there is a new Kattenstedt that takes place, and this is a lively procession that has about 2,000 participants. They're dressed in whimsical costumes ranging from cats and mice and witches and sorcerers to fairy tale characters. There's a huge parade where there's a collection of floats that depict cats and local legends and the history of Ypres. There's giants and medieval figures, and there's male and female cats striding alongside dancers and musicians through the town streets. It's super gorgeous. Just go look online. Just type in Kattenstedt. I'll put it in the show notes. Kattenstoet is how it's spelled, and Ypres is Ypres. So you can just look that up. And after the parade's procession, the revelers gather at the city hall known as the Cloth Hall. And here, a town jester tosses, wait for it, toy cats from the bell tower to the crowd below. They also have a mock witch burning. A puppet witch is burned. And this used to just be a local event, and it's now grown to nearly 50,000 spectators from coming from all across the country in Belgium. So it's a big deal. You can go see it yourself. So aside from throwing the cats from the belfry tower, you know, people did see cats being useful for controlling pests, for controlling, you know, rats and mice. They were helpful indoors in households, but they also were valued on, you know, ships and by merchants who found them beneficial for protecting their cargo, especially when they had grain during transportation and storage, right? But negative perceptions surrounding black cats in particular and their association with witchcraft persisted and made its way across the Atlantic, courtesy of the Puritan colonists, who continued these superstitions about cats being the devil incarnate or witches' familiars, or the witches themselves in cat form. And this evolved and became associated with Halloween here in North America. And so the cat would continue to be seen this way in this negative light, really until the Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century. If you remember the episode I did about monuments to cats, I talked about the life of Samuel Johnson and how Boswell talked about Johnson's affection for cats. We have, you know, Mark Twain talking about cats in the 19th century. And so you do eventually have this positive depiction of cats. But honestly, there's still a lot of negative perceptions about cats in general, and black cats in particular. And so I'd really, really encourage you in any way you can to change that perception. And there's a lot of ways we can do that. Before I talk about a couple of these ways, how we can change the depictions of cats during Halloween and other animals during Halloween, I just want to recommend a couple episodes. If you are interested in more about the human-cat connection, human-animal connection, there are lots of podcast episodes I've done about this. You can listen to an episode called The History of Pet Cemeteries. You can listen to an episode called Poetry's Plea for Animals, where poets over the century have written just the most beautiful poems about animals. There's an episode called Monuments to Animals that I just referenced about kind of physical, amazing stone fountains, monuments, celebrating animals, and cats play into this a lot. I have an episode called Man's Place in the Animal World by Mark Twain. It's about his book called Man's Place in the Animal World. I did an episode called Cat Cafes, Harmful or Helpful. I have an episode called Better is Better, The Emotional and Practical Aspects of Fostering Dogs and Cats. So lots to listen to if you're interested. But if you want to stick around a little longer, I'm just going to talk about how we can promote awareness about really how amazing animals are and how black cats are and cats. I have a bias toward black cats in particular. I've only ever adopted black cats, specifically black tuxedo cats. And yet I will say that even after all these times and we think we're a sophisticated bunch of people, black cats historically and continue to be the least adopted cats in shelters. And so there's a lot we can do to change that perception. A lot of animal shelters and rescue organizations actively promote the adoption of black cats. You can help with that this time of year. And so there's a lot to do to just educate the public about how amazing these animals are. I happen to think that black cats are kind of special. I think they're, I talk about black, especially tuxedo cats, being very dog-like because they have attributes that people really appreciate about dogs, even though obviously every individual is different. But yeah, that's just something you can do, is to encourage people to adopt black cats from shelters. You can promote whatever shelters and organizations near you who are specializing in black cat adoption, because a lot of organizations do promote black cat adoptions this time of year. I know this sounds maybe silly, but I actually don't include black cats in my Halloween decorations. I have permanent black cat decor because of Charlie and Michiko, but I don't include black cats as part of my Halloween decor. I don't want to perpetuate that idea that they're somehow linked to something dark and nefarious. Now, I don't think Halloween is about nefariousness and evil. I actually do think Halloween in this time of year is a really special time to celebrate, oh gosh, all of the things that we associate with this season, which has to do with, you know, the time that things do die before they come back to life again. That's really powerful. I think that's a really powerful idea. I don't think that's evil, but obviously there is so much associated with Halloween and evil. And I don't want cats to be part of that. And I don't want other animals to be part of that either. And so you've got that with rats. There was, I think the people moved, but down the street, you know, because this time of year, our street is, every house is decorated for Halloween. And there was a house, there is a house down the street where the people who used to live there, they used to put out kind of these rubber rats and traps, you know. So the idea is like all these rats were like they were in the traps. And I hated seeing that. And they had like 10 of them outside on their front lawn. So one day when I was walking by and I was so afraid they were going to see me through the window, I don't think they did. I think they would have said something. I removed the rats from the traps. I didn't steal the rats or the thing, but I did remove the rats from the traps because I just hated this idea that they were promoting rats being used in these clap traps, like that kind of trap. And so I removed them. So that's another example of an animal who I think is an incredibly, they're intelligent, they're affectionate, they're family oriented, they're social, they're adaptable, they're resilient rats, and they just get the worst reputation, right? They just get the worst reputation as being dirty and, you know, associated with epidemics and plagues and, you know, they just get a really bad rap. So we can change that by obviously not depicting rats as being part of this kind of dirty, dark part of Halloween. I do have an episode called humanely dealing with uninvited critters in our homes, because we did have rats for several years in our attic. And it took several years for us to find all the places they were getting in. And I was live trapping these rats. They're just adorable. I was live trapping them and releasing them. And at the same time, we were trying to find all the ways they were getting in. And so I have a lot to say about how to deal with uninvited critters. Bats were also considered witches' companions. And again, that just means that they were seen as being evil and nefarious and all of that. So bats continued to be wrongly demonized, and they are incredibly valuable in and of themselves, but incredibly valuable to our environment. They're adaptable. They are, you know, they are pollinators, you know, so keep growing those plants. They eat insects. They can eat over 1,000 flying insects in a single night. And they also spread fruit and seeds through their feces, like a lot of animals do. So bats are incredibly important. You can put you can change the way people think about it by the way we talk about these animals, certainly on social media. You can also hang a bat house to encourage them to your house. We put a bat house up, I don't know, several years ago. I have no idea if the bats use it. It's just way high up. I can't even see it. I mean, I can see it, but it's very high up. We do have bats where we live, but I don't know if I helped at all, but that's something you can do and keep, again, planting those pollen-rich flowers. Owls have been a universal symbol for spookiness. I think owls are appreciated a bit more than these other animals are, especially these other birds like crows and ravens. But still, there have been people who see them as being kind of, you know, dark and, you know, I don't know, like messengers of evil, right? They've evoked fear in people. Again, you can hear them, but you can't see them. They're hidden. They're kind of mysterious. Of course, they're amazing. And I think people are always freaked out by predators, and they are predatorial birds. You can hear them. You can see them, you know, killing other animals. But in that way, you know, that's good because, you know, they keep down the numbers of other animals. And so you can also put a owl boxes, just like you can put up a bat box. Now, not every owl nests in boxes. Like we have great horned owls and we hear them every night, especially this time of year. It is the most wonderful sound. We hear owls every night. And I wanted to put up owl boxes. And so I actually did reach out to my wildlife group. There's a wonderful group called the Hungry Owl Project. I think it's associated with WildCare up in San Rafael here in California, Northern California. But reach out to an organization in your area. I reached out because I was like, I want to help and I want to build an owl box. And I worked with the person there to identify the owls that we have here, and they are great horned owls, and great horned owls don't use boxes. So in the end, we don't need to build any boxes because they're just fine in the trees on their own in an open, you know, branch. They don't need boxes. But if you have screech owls or barn owls, you can help them out by building an owl box. So you can even go to the Hungry Owl Project, even if they're not near you, and they have tips for building the boxes. But just any animal that you know are, you know, demonized this time of year. Spiders are another example. Crows and ravens are another example. Toads are another example. So there's a lot of ways that we can change people's perceptions of these animals who are often demonized. I have more episodes you can listen to. I have one called How to Talk About Wild Animals. I have one called If You Care About Wildlife. You should just listen to that. I have one called Is Wildlife Tourism Bad or Good for Animals? One's called Helping or Hindering Wildlife When Baby Fawns Need Intervention. So lots about wildlife, and certainly do how we talk about them makes a huge difference. How we frame them in our discourse and just in our interactions with other people when we're talking about any of these animals. So I hope that helps. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have, please share it. Please leave a positive rating or review. Please support this podcast. You can do all of this at joyfulvegan.com, or you can go to wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review. If you are interested in traveling with me, we've got some spots open for our amazing all-inclusive trips. You can find all of that at joyfulvegan.com for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks so much for listening, and happy Halloween.